Deezer Originals.
You're listening to the Strong and Stable podcast. Before we start this week's show, we would like to send a message of support to everyone affected by the fire at Grenfell Tower and the attack at Finsbury Park Mosque. The thoughts and love of everyone at the show are with you.
Now, it's time for Strong and Stable.
Strong and Stable, 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 Strong and Stable.
Hello, I'm Marcus Brigstock and welcome to this week's edition of Strong and Stable, another week in which the British have shown that we won't be bowed by terrorism, but we will fall apart if there's more than two sunny days in a row. Joining me in the studio this week, we have a journalist who writes for the Sunday Times, so her first comment today will be free to listen to, but the rest will be hidden behind a paywall. It's Camilla Long. Next up, a comedian whose Edinburgh show last year was called Simply the Best. No, sorry, it was called Simply the Best. That's the Tina Turner lawsuit off his hands. It's Richard Herring. And finally, fresh from doubling his Norwich South majority at this election, with, we're fairly sure, even the city's most famous son, Alan Partridge, switching from Tory to Labour, probably because of the plans to pedestrianise Norwich city centre. It's Labour MP Clive Lewis. So, welcome, everybody. First of all, how are you?
Hot.
Okay.
Quite sweaty.
Nice.
No. I'm very, very tired, Marcus. I've got to... I've woken up. Yeah, it's because I'm heavily pregnant.
Okay. For people listening, we should say Camilla is expecting her first child in... hopefully before the end of the podcast.
Yeah, that's, during...
We can... I'm going to... Yeah, I'll push the boat out.
You must have caught it
a
boat.
No, sorry, no, I won't do that. I mean the opposite of that.
Yeah, yeah.
I'll keep it in, hopefully.
Okay. Very good. Okay. Well, let's kick off with Brexit, a nice red, white and blue one that seems to have turned a deep shade of brown. Yes, Brexit negotiations began with the EU in Brussels this week, and while the government went into the talks insisting there can be no changes to our Brexit plan, because there isn't one, the British team immediately proved themselves to be unable to take back control even of the negotiating timetable. Our chief negotiator, David Davis... Oh, sorry, he really is. Wow. Our chief negotiator, David Davis, meanwhile, has said that he's determined to achieve a Brexit deal that works for the whole of the UK, forgetting that the deal that would work for the whole of the UK would be staying in the EU. So, what do you make of Britain's negotiating success so far? Clive, I think we'll come to you first on this. That seems reasonable.
I don't know. It's far too early to say. But it doesn't look good. I mean, Theresa may well want to say, you know, in the Monty Python, Black Knight style, it's just a flesh wound. But the bottom line is she's been, you know, severely decapitated as anyone who can go into those negotiations with any semblance of authority. And that's bad for all of us. It's bad for the country. It's bad for the city. It's bad for the various sectors of manufacturing. Everyone now, I think, is concerned that, you know, Michael Barnier is looking at her and he's got his knife and fork out and he's kind of sharpening it. And it doesn't look good for us because she has been fundamentally weakened.
Camilla, do you think, I mean, given the Tories now have lost their majority, lost lots of their credibility, do you think they can make a success of these negotiations?
Well, I think Theresa May is going to hang on by her nails for as long as she can. I mean, I think the idea that we're going to see a whole change in 3 months' time is probably not going to happen. I'd be surprised if she didn't hang on till Christmas, which will mean I think they're currently in bunker hiding mode, waiting for the political climate to change. And it will change because things can change so fast. Mm. But they're definitely, I mean, as we've seen, you know, many times in the last 6 weeks. So I think it's a waiting game for them at the moment. And they're hoping that nobody notices that they're just waiting around for the climate to change. And people want to and will forget that the election has been a total catastrophe.
What do you think the kind of climate changes could be? I mean, because obviously the ticking time bomb is the economy. And I think the longer they wait, the worse. The whole, one of the reasons for having the election according when it was because I think they knew there was going to be some kind of economic turmoil. 2022 would have given them the chance to be able to, you know, got past that and started a recovery. But now it looks
I mean, today you've got these figures are coming through saying that the economy is worse off because of Brexit. I'm not sure how much I believe that or whether it's you know, going to be a long-term thing. But I think as soon as people start realising that it's impacting their daily lives, that
there's a very good article on I can't remember who wrote it, sadly, but about the poll tax and the community charge and how that all went through and no one really was worried about it until they suddenly saw the economic repercussions of it, and at which point they're all rioting in the streets. And I just think that exactly the same thing is going to happen with this. People are all, you know, I don't understand. It's not a mandate in any sense.
No.
It's nearly a draw followed by an election that says, no, we don't want you to have a hard Brexit. So it's absolutely just befuddled on tour. I know there was some discussion about doing Brexit jokes on tour. Oh. I did a few, but the thing that really resonated with my audience was that we should never have been asked to vote on this subject in the first place. It wasn't our decision, and we didn't know enough about it. The politicians don't know enough about it. No one knows enough about it. No one knows what's going to happen. So
would it have been unreasonable to make people sit an exam before answering that particular question?
No, it should have been a political decision. What it is, we're being played by, you know, the Conservative Party trying to seal up its divisions and the Labour Party trying to seal up its divisions as well, and to some extent. And it's about the parties. It's not about the people, which I think increasingly is what people are noticing. Politicians are trying to do what they think people want, and then the people come back and go, that's not what we want.
I think for people listening, obviously, that this is not at the moment even-handed, so I'm going to try and even it up a bit. I think there is a good chance economically that Brexit will mean that Britain suffers, but I do think when people see and are able to hold in their hand a blue passport, it'll all seem worthwhile.
Yes, silence. Yes, that'll be definitely.
Bananas are definitely bendy still.
And in a much, much, much longer queue, a separate longer queue at all European airports.
We're good at queuing, but we're good at that, aren't we?
Well, no, people will have time then to reflect on on sovereignty and how important it is. Just in that queue.
And you know, the point that Al Murray makes in his show, which no one I've seen anyone else make, which is a brilliant point, is that being in the EU gives us, you know, we get a decision about what happens in Europe. It's not just about Europe deciding what happens to us. Yeah. Well, and by being not part of Europe, we don't get any say in what happens in Europe.
I don't know what newspapers Al Murray's been reading, but it's certainly not the British.
Strong and stable.
During the election, during the general election, it sounds weird to say during the general election it's happened, but during the general election, there was one positive that I did see come, one silver lining, which was I was speaking to a lot of young people, and they didn't tell me whether they voted or not for Brexit or against, but most, they were Remainers. Whether they voted or not, I don't know. But what they all uniformly said was what Brexit vote did, the referendum, it made me realise that my vote actually matters.
Yeah.
And I know that's something that
they
applies to
a year too late.
Not in this general election they didn't. And what I think is reminding people of, I think there's been a kind of atomization over the last kind of, I don't know, 30, 40 years of kind of the individualism that's kind of permeated through our society. And people kind of think, well, I only just one vote, it doesn't make a difference. But I think what Brexit showed people across the political spectrum, across the class spectrum, was that your vote actually does matter and it can change things. And these young people said to me when I was campaigning, I may or may not have voted in that, but I did see how it can affect my life and how it can change things. And I'm going to make sure I vote this time. And that's, I think, in part why there was a big surge.
Do you think that Corbyn did so well because people were voting for Corbyn or against Brexit?
I think there are so many factors that make up why we did as we did. And Corbyn is definitely one of them. I think there are lots of reasons for that, in the way he's been treated. He's an outsider, an establishment. There's all those factors. But there's also things about people who lent their votes. There's the kind of the division between Remainers and Brexiteers, and people feeling that actually Labour was the best chance to stop a hard Brexit, which was obviously the kind of the big danger for a lot of Remainers. So I think there's a kind of... One of the problems, I think, for my party at the moment is there is some lazy thinking going on what won it for us. I think Jeremy Corbyn was essential to winning it, but I think there are lots of other factors
in
there.
You didn't win it.
No, yes.
You came a very credible second.
Sometimes it feels like it. Jeremy Corbyn got us to within 40% of the vote. And I think,
it's so extraordinary. I mean, to go, and you know, it's not even the polls, it goes from local elections which showed where Labour were 6 weeks, whatever it was, before the general election, or he was even closer than that to the general election. The turnaround was incredible. Yeah. And so it is so complex. It's about so many things. Yeah. And in fact, if it wasn't about so many things, Labour might have won because, you know, the Scottish National Party losing some seats to the Tories throws things in a different direction, you know, and that's about something different. There's so many things piling in on this.
But just an interesting development, funny enough, on the Brexit negotiations. I read this morning that Nigel Farage has had a BBC interview chair surgically grafted to his arse for the next 2 years. He will have just a permanent slot at the BBC. But we will leave Brexit there. Now it's time for us to hear from the woman who's providing strong and stable leadership for the whole country. Yes, it's the Queen. Let's go over to Buckingham Palace to hear the first draft of her speech for this week's state opening of Parliament.
My lords and members of the House of Commons, apologies for the delay to my speech this year. My government could not find the skin of a helpless animal on which to print the official documents. They should have looked in number 10. Seriously, I am told there was no goatskin available on which to record today's proceedings. I blame the nanny state. Oh, dear, do you see what one did there? As a result of this delay, one has been forced to forego one's usual outing to Royal Ascot, although my government's recent election campaign has provided one with ample exposure to also-rans who fall at the first hurdle. Talking of lame old nags who are fit for the knacker's yard, my Prime Minister, Theresa May, has provided one with an assurance that one will still be able to get away in time to see the races. But then she assured one she wouldn't call an election till 2020, so one is taking that with a Lorna handbag full of salt. However, given that my task today is to lay out my government's legislative programme based on what's left of their election manifesto, one should be out of here faster than my government doing a U-turn on dementia tax. So, without further ado, my government regrets to announce that sadly there is no magic money tree to pay for increased support to the elderly, unless the elderly in question live in Buckingham Palace, and my government will continue with its Brexit plan, or as one calls it, the planus horribilis. So in short, one is going to the nags, and the rest of the country is going to the dogs.
Many thanks to Her Majesty there, which is what Jan Ravens insists on being called these days, and frankly, who can blame her?
Strong and stable.
Well, in a week that's made you wonder whether we should turn the world off and then on again, the main story has, of course, been the horrific fire at Grenfell Tower in West London. Was the extent of the tragedy exacerbated by government cuts, local council failings? Was it because of a refusal to impose regulations and a disgusting lack of concern for the poorest in our society? Nope. As the Daily Mail helpfully made it clear, it was caused by an Ethiopian taxi driver's faulty fridge. They even managed to find an old photo of him on holiday with a drink, acting almost as if he didn't even know this was all going to happen. Theresa May's failure to meet with residents on site was blamed on security concerns, or as they're more commonly known, ordinary people. Jeremy Corbyn, meanwhile, has argued for property to be requisitioned, causing many Tory MPs to go on the defensive, which is very easy if you live in a castle, apparently. So, Camilla, what did you make of Theresa May's response? I mean, first of all, has the criticism of her been fair and reasonable, do you think?
I think it's been fair. Whether it's been entirely reasonable, I don't know. I think she did make a mistake on Wednesday by not immediately engaging with the problem. And you'd have thought that after the election and it being a moment for her to show leadership, it would have gone a bit better. Or gone at all. And the idea that, you know, she sort of went down there and didn't even meet people was pretty appalling, only to be upstaged by nearly everybody else, including Andrea Leadsom. Mm. So I think, yes, I think she did play it badly at every... And also, the real thing, I think, is that never mind about her turning up, because I'm sure we'll get into the emotional correctness of whether she should have cried on camera or not. What she didn't do was immediately arrange relief and have, you know, supplies coming in for people who'd basically lost their homes in the last 12 hours.
But even 3 or 4 days later, I mean, she was so out of kilter with it. So even when she finally says, we're going to give money for clothes and food, But I live in Shepherd's Bush, and all the people in Shepherd's Bush and North Kensington and everywhere around West London had just got together and already produced enough clothes for 10,000 people. There was everyone was turning stuff away. We'd already done all that. We need, you know, she needed
something, there's something kind of sort of, you know, a bit grisly about just offering a cash package to somebody, you know.
Well, it's awful. By that stage, it was, we need to work out, hey, what's, you know, if she'd gone down straight away, she didn't need to say, we'll work out what's happened. That, for the moment, that does not matter.
Yeah.
We need to make the people safe. We need to, you know, make sure the firefighters are fine. And, you know, we need to sort all those things out. If she'd gone down there, then people, I mean, she could have actually turned everything around for her, but she did the same. I mean, exactly the same thing she did in the election. which is what lost her the election.
It's
she
really
stayed, she did that interview with, it was Emily Makeless she did the interview with. And Emily had been down helping out and was very emotional.
Yeah.
And it's not about crying. It's about just being a human being and just, like, not going in with a fucking script.
I think, you know, people often accuse politicians of being out of touch. And some are and some aren't. You know, you can generalise. But I just think if you look at Theresa May, and you can see she's a human being. She clearly feels for these people. I have no doubt about that. I can see that. And I have no reason to believe that she doesn't. But I just believe, in terms of, you can either blame her advisors or you can blame herself. But she just, that was just called so badly. You know, clearly there was a point where someone said, are you going to meet people here? And at some point, someone, and the buck does stop with her, said no, because there could be scenes where there are people becoming very difficult. There could be boos, there could be jeers. And that call was made not to do it. And I think, you know, she'll regret that for as long as her political career lasts.
And where she didn't join in with the debates. And then she should have learned, it's better, you know, you're damned if you do, you're better to do.
But I guess the kind of the programming within her is such that, and no pun intended, but the program with her is such that she couldn't. It's something that is alien to her.
Yeah. I mean, if I'm not, I should make that clear. If I were advising Theresa May, she won't even answer my calls. It's extraordinary. But in this particular situation, her chief of staff, as I understand it, was responsible for implementing some changes that could have made a difference to this. It's quite possible that the end result of the inquiries will show that the policies of austerity have made this worse. It seems likely that Kensington and Chelsea, which is a Conservative council who are sitting on a £300 million reserve, spent £5 million on the opera and have built 10 social housing homes in their borough in the last 28 years. Her foreign secretary, when he was mayor of London, made massive cuts to the fire service, and when told that could make things dangerous, said, get stuffed. I'm not sure politically that there was anywhere to go for Theresa May on every level. I think it's reckless to suggest that at this stage, that the extent of the fire, the blame can be put squarely in one place or another. We simply don't know yet. But everywhere Theresa May turned, and the Conservatives, it seems to me, this is, on some level, they're involved in this. This was not just a terrible accident.
Do you think it was Theresa May, or do you think it was the Cameroons? Because I would say it was, and that was, it was right on their doorstep. I would say they were a bit more responsible for that, given that they were actually in power at that point.
Yeah.
I think it's deeper and more systemic. I think it goes to an ideology, call it what you want, Thatcherism, Reaganomics, neoliberalism, but it's a philosophy, an economic, political philosophy, which basically mandates people, the environment, as units to be squeezed for profit.
Yeah, I should say Strong and Stable is predominantly a comedy podcast. I hope that listeners will understand why the laughs have been as sparse as they quite rightly have been on this
particular topic. I'm trying to stay awake at the moment, because every time I go to sleep, I wake up and something terrible's
happened. Something awful's happened,
I'm just trying to stay awake the whole time.
Well, trust in politicians is running at its lowest since nearly an hour ago. Interestingly, Jeremy Corbyn said that property should be seized, and by way of example has moved into number 10. So let's see how that goes. Now it's our post-election summary from Jonathan Pye, the reporter with his ear to the ground, his nose to the grindstone, and his throat never far away from a pint of pissy lager. Jonathan, over to you.
Is this on?
Yep.
So, right, sorry, you want me to sum up the last 4 weeks in roughly 2 minutes? Sure, yeah, piece of piss, Marcus, because, you know, nothing much has happened. All right, some things have changed and some things haven't. Pulitzer's in the Post, right? All right, Theresa May, or Terry Mayhem, as she's now known, has changed her job title from Prime Minister to House Sitter-in-Chief. It's like a murder mystery weekend at Number 10 right now. We all know who the victim is going to be, and it's not so much of a question of who done it as who'll do it and when. She's also changed her motto from strong and stable to I got us into this mess, I'll get us out of it. It doesn't quite have the same ring, does it? Perhaps she should try I don't know what the fuck I'm doing, for God's sake, someone get me out of here, please. It's not pretty, is it? I mean, she really got it in the tits for not meeting the victims of the Grenfell fire. But seriously, I don't know why everyone was so angry. I mean, Lily Allen was on hand to answer questions about social housing policy. So what's the big fucking problem? And, you know, the victims and their families, they don't need state intervention now. Because, you know, Simon Cowell is going to make a charity single. Problem solved. What else has changed? Tim Farron's gone. Doesn't really feel like we've lost a big political beast, does it, really? More a medium-sized political stoat or badger. Something you'd kill with a spade. Yeah. What? Don't forget to ask about his religion. Why the fuck would I mention that? Why would I take the piss out of someone for having a different belief system than my own? As far as I can see, this man has not in any way allowed his faith to interfere with his voting record, which on LGBT rights is exemplary, and that's good enough for me. Can you imagine if Sadiq Khan quit because of his faith? People wouldn't be quite so quick to fucking mock, would they? Nothing gets up my chuff more than liberals having double standards. Some commentators are saying that the election result will hail a change of heart on Australia. But there's no change there, I'm afraid. Not with Jeremy Cockney rhyming slang Hunt still in charge of the NHS. That isn't a change of heart unless you're changing the heart from a stone to an ice cube. It's something else that has stayed the same. The media. Still keeping a level head whenever the world goes to shit. Oh, nope, sorry, different universe. I mean, why bother asking serious questions and demanding serious answers when you can instead turn into a 24-hour rolling grief porn channel? We spoke to someone earlier who has lost everything, including loved ones. Let's watch them cry. And then name and shame them for having a dodgy fridge. OK, anyway, ready for some substandard make-it-up-as-I-go-along political commentary, Marcus? Yep. OK. Jonathan Pye here with an in-depth look at the
strong and stable.
Thank you, Jonathan. And now it is indeed time to talk about that political stoat himself, Tim Farron. Yep, Tim stood down as leader of the Liberal Democrats this week to the dismay of the 48% of the population who actually knew who he was.
I'm annoyed I just managed to learn his name.
Yeah.
Really had. It took me that long by the end of the election.
Come on, Tim. You'll be all right. Come on, Tim.
Come on, Tim.
Doing his very best REM impression, that's me in the spotlight, choosing my religion, Farron explained his decision by saying that he had to be faithful to Chris. No, sorry, that should be Christ. And was determined to show that he's as committed to his beliefs as the next man, provided the next man isn't gay. Jo Swinson, meanwhile, has demonstrated that she has all the maturity and good sense that would make an excellent Lib Dem leader by choosing not to run for Lib Dem leader. She's also a woman, which of course rules her out anyway. Was Tim Farron right to resign, Rich?
I mean, I don't think it matters, does it?
No, probably not.
It doesn't really matter who's in charge of the Liberals. I mean, you think he could have stayed. I don't think it would have made much difference. I think they're a kind of spent force. Unfortunately, a spent force. If they couldn't get anything out of this election, you know, I think then there's not really any hope for them, I think. I just think the mistrust of them goes too deep. But, you know, it's a weird thing, isn't it? Just anyone who wants to be the leader of a political party should not be allowed to be the leader of the political party. And he seemed a decent enough guy, but he was just so wet. And really, just I think in a week's time, you'll say, who was the last leader of the Liberal Party? And I'll go, oh, I can't remember.
Yeah. Clive, who do you think would be a good leader?
I was thinking of Jo Swinson, but she's just ruled herself out. And it'd be nice. It would be good to have a woman as on the Liberal Democrats. I think it'd be the first time. So
have someone who isn't a ginger-haired man, wouldn't it? Just for the first time in about five decades.
I think she. No. Anyway. So yeah. I know Vince Kay. I know him to say hello to and so on. And I think he's a very competent, capable individual. Yes. I think he has some gravitas as well, which I think Tim was lacking. And I think we can be very unkind about Tim. It's bloody difficult being leader of a party. And unfortunately, I know a lot has been made about the play on his faith, but actually, he bet the house on a Brexit vote, and it didn't particularly materialise in this election.
Did they, though? They seemed to come in and then suddenly go, oh, we'll be soft Brexit. So, you know, I think if they just come in and said, we're going to have another referendum.
Well, they did.
But then they sort of pulled away from it straight away.
But it just it wasn't the issue. I mean, obviously in parts of the country it became an issue, but more in the Remain, in the Brexit areas, in a lot of Remain cities, I think people got behind it because people expected there to be a Tory landslide. People got behind what they saw as the best, you know, many Liberal voters got behind what they saw as the best opportunity and tactical voted and got behind the best opportunity to stop that, which was in many cases the Labour Party. And as the Labour Party campaign picked up and gathered momentum, they found it easier.
I think he had a massive opportunity and he squandered it because he was a div. Full stop.
On the question of sin and gay sex and that stuff.
On the question of Brexit, I think that he had a huge opportunity to turn it into, because now we're looking back on the general election, it's much, much, much more about Brexit than we thought it was.
But why didn't the Lib Dems do better?
Instead of the Labour Party taking over.
If you looked at the leaflets that came out, the ones that dominant, the only leaflets I got that came through my door, I mean, it was obviously had funding issues, but the big issue was it was an attack on Corbyn.
Just to clarify on that point, you said about a leaflet coming through your door, Clive. Do you also get people knocking on the door and asking if they can rely on your vote for another party?
I have had that happen before,
How long do you keep them there before you tell them?
Well, normally within the first 15 to 20 seconds. They know But that often used to happen when I was a bit more of a low-key, just a candidate before I came. But
they might talk you around, you never know. It'd be pretty impressive when I've managed to convince the Labour candidate to vote
for my housemate would answer the door. My housemate would answer the door and they would talk to them for 5-10 minutes. And I would jump out and go, it's my house.
There was a very pleasing tweet from Nihal Arthanayeg. I hope I've pronounced that correctly. I probably haven't, but he said, Sir Vince. No. Now I'll go again. From a chap called Nihal. Informal. He tweeted, Sir Vince Cable is 74 years old, which means by the next general election, he will be 74 years old. Are they a menace to the left-wing vote, do you think, Clive, the Lib Dems? I mean, how much better do you think Labour would have done if the Lib Dems had just gone, look, we're just not going to run anybody?
That would have been fantastic. It would have been great. But obviously that's not going to happen. I mean, are they a menace? Well, in a first-past-the-post system, you know, any centre-centre-left parties are fighting over many of the same pool of voters. So that means that there will be winners and losers on that side. And ultimately, those on the centre and centre-left of politics will, compared to the Conservatives, who have managed in recent years, nonetheless, to sweep up and mop up the right side of politics, means that, you know, disproportionately, we're going to lose out. So they are an impediment to the Labour Party. But, you know, there are lots of Liberal Democrat voters who say, well, the Labour Party are an impediment to us.
Yeah, sure.
And that is the conundrum of the first-past-the-post system, and for progressive parties to be able to kind of get over that line.
It's strong and stable.
Finally, following the revelation this week that 30% of Sun readers voted Labour, the other 70% are still looking for page 3 on the ballot paper, we thought it was time to discuss the role that the media has played in this last general election. When it comes to old media, the power of the newspapers does appear to be waning, although TV remains important, with Corbyn faring well in that arena due to his improved performances and May faring less well due to her lack of showing up, or indeed showing up and then being Theresa May when she got there. But social media is the real battleground now, and it seems that the left are winning there too, which isn't surprising, perhaps, as they've always wanted to seize the memes of production. Guys?
Yeah?
The memes of production.
No, I don't get it.
Nothing?
No.
No, I'll write it down and explain it. Camilla, your best place to answer this, I think. Is it really a case of old media versus new media now?
I think that's what people want it to be, but I don't really feel like that. I'm on Twitter, but I also write a column in a national newspaper. I think, you know, it's all methods of communication. It's a bit like saying when television came in, it was going to kill radio. But obviously they exist in two very beautiful and different forms.
One of the problems for me on the media as a politician isn't just the kind of overt. In fact, you know, the Sun and the Mail, I think, you know, the fact that 30% of Sun readers vote Labour kind of says that the people who read it for other things. They might, I know people who turn to the Sun and go to the back page first. I know people who do it for the crossword, whatever. The people that buy the Sun for a variety of reasons.
A lot of Daily Express readers just do colouring in.
there's lots of reasons you buy that paper. And I just, to me, though, the far more kind of almost sinister, pervasive element of journalism, modern journalism, is the fact that it sets out a narrative. And it's a very subtle, it's almost transparent. And I've seen it on the BBC, I've seen it on ITV, I've seen it on Sky. It's a lack of questioning of certain assumptions that are made and aren't questioned. What is the news agenda? What is news? And how they're defining news? What's important? What's not important? And I think that's far more subtle and that's far more corrosive to the body politic. Now, as a fourth estate, I think the role of media, by and large, is to challenge power. I was a journalist and that's what I wanted to do. I wasn't always able to do it because of news values, sometimes because of what was considered news and what was not. So there are a whole range of reasons. But I think one of the key things about the new media that's coming out at the moment is that it is the kind of embodiment of so-called citizen journalism.
Do these people really break lots of news? I don't think they do. I think they're opinionators,
which is
a very narrow. Yeah, but they don't check. They don't check whether the news is real or not. Because they don't have time. Because all they're doing is sitting behind their computers, wanking into their screens.
There's also a peculiar thing, and I do not understand why broadcast media still holds print media as their seniors. On a regular basis, you'll hear on the Today programme, you'll see on Question Time, on Newsnight, they will say, according to a report in, according to the editor of, blah, 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 blah. For me, the biggest stories, apart from Brexit and Trump, the biggest story is the Panama Papers. It's way more interesting than MPs' expenses. Way bigger. Way bigger. And there is so much material there. Where is it?
Yeah.
Where did that story go? Because if tax avoidance in the UK were not happening in the way that it is, austerity simply wouldn't be necessary. Not in the terms that it's in now. That story is not there. Those stories disappear. And they disappear always in favour of these poor people took more than we think they should.
Yeah.
And that's just across the board. And I look forward to the day that someone on Newsnight or whatever begins with, there's a story in such and such a paper, which is of no interest to us. Here's what we did in our own...
But that's how everything works. Everyone gets the paper still and does that.
There's a strange difference.
But it's the same thing with politicians. People don't trust politicians because of expenses, because of a few people. It just takes a couple of politicians and then people go, all politicians are the same, we don't trust them. And it's so unfair on the vast majority of hardworking politicians.
Right. I'm being told we're out of time.
No,
I'm not sure why. I mean, ours is the first generation.
It's because you're dark overlords here on the internet. We've got too close to the truth. It's mainstream media.
It's a conspiracy.
I'm being dragged out of the room. Help me.
Get these people off me.
This is Strong and Stable.
Okay, predictions. Before we go, I'm going to ask you all for a few predictions. Where will the major parties be in the polls this time next year, Camilla?
Oh my God, that's a bit like...
Okay. You'll have a baby by then. It'll be nearly one. This will matter.
Yes.
Will you be okay?
I have a horrible feeling we'll probably be in exactly the same position.
Clive, who's going to be our Prime Minister this time next year?
I'm an optimist. I think that... that we will be in a position where we will be potentially able to come to power. I think what we do know is that things flick from one side to the other. It can twist and turn. Mm-hmm. But I think that the worm is turning. I think you mustn't get carried away with it. But I actually do think that if there's a steady hand on the tiller, I think if we sit back and wait, the Tories have created a terrible mess for themselves. I think it's about sitting back and waiting. And the chickens will come home to roost.
And which cabinet position will you be? Sorry, I'm just
actually, my wife has told me I'm not going onto the cabinet. She's told me that I'm going to spend the first few years of married life with her. And there you go.
I get
so you're spending more time with family before you're leaving. That's pretty. That's an unusual way around to do it.
Andrea Leadsom,
yes.
Amber Rudd, David Davis, Boris Johnson... or another, who do you think will be Prime Minister when Theresa May finally...
Oh, my God. I just hope it's not Boris Johnson or Michael Gove. I mean, I can't see them wangling it.
I don't see it happening.
I mean, I think probably David Davis seems to be the one that, I think he's got a very punchable face and it looks like it's been punched quite a few times already.
Okay, quick fire round. Rich, Amber Rudd or Paul Rudd?
Well, it's got to be Paul Rudd. He's somehow managed to stay the same age for 30 years, hasn't he?
Yes.
I'm not saying Amber Rudd hasn't.
Sure. Camilla, extreme Brexit or extreme breakfast?
Oh, Extreme Breakfast.
Always delicious.
Yeah, absolutely.
Strong and stable.
Just before we go, we would like to say thank you to everyone who's left us a review on Twitter, Facebook, or wherever you download your podcast from. We'd particularly like to thank Rusty Shah, who wrote, "Good to hear a mix of views in episode one. Bob Mills plays the part of my 76-year-old mum exceptionally well." So if any of the guests today have reminded you of any of your family members, do please let us know by leaving your own review. It means a lot, especially if it's nice. And that is it from us. I have been Marcus Brigstock, as I will continue to be for the rest of the afternoon. And this has been Strong and Stable, a podcast produced by That Lot for Deezer. Huge thanks to our guests today, who have been Clive Lewis, Camilla Long and Richard Herring, and to the brilliant Jonathan Pye and Jan Ravens, of course, and also to our writers, Andrea Mann, Robin Flavel, Dan Bowman and James Martin. Most of all, though, thank you to you for listening. While we're sad to say this is the last Strong and Stable of the series, no, really, don't worry. We will be back with more jokes, rants and political nonsense later in the year, as will our politicians, no doubt. So don't forget to hit subscribe and keep your eyes peeled and your ears readier than when David Dimbleby announced the result of that exit poll. Until then, thank you and goodbye.
That was Strong and Stable. We'll catch you next time. Please subscribe.
Strong and Stable is a Deezer Originals production. You can find and download more episodes on Deezer and all major podcast providers.
Deezer Originals.